you're listening to this recording, it means that I am dead. So this won't be a live show this week, but we've still got some great music lined up for you on WRCT Pittsburgh's The Atom Smasher. First up, we'll do a couple of songs off of Sandpiper's new album, Outdoor Shower. You can find these guys on the typical streaming platforms. After that, some more new music from our music directors before passing it over to our automated tracks, followed by Dream Suite at 9 p.m. All this and more on WRCT Pittsburgh.
Sorry to know you like that. Symmetrical ways that you act. It's nothing that's well off my back. So why is this feeling so bad? I'm sorry I know you. I'm not feeling so cool. I strung through this whirlpool with nothing else to do. I'm feeling so
Alright, that's a wrap on Sandpiper. Again, those tracks were from their newest album, Outdoor Shower. We'll be switching it up with some tracks now from our music directors, followed by, again, Dream Suite at 9 p.m.
Is the most prevalent tick-borne illness, with about 220,000 new cases occurring each year. Believe it or not, you can test negative for Lyme and still be infected. Many victims of Lyme report never seeing a bullseye rash, and it can be very difficult to diagnose because it mimics other illnesses, such as multiple sclerosis, ALS, and Alzheimer's. To learn more, go to www.lymediseaseassociation.org.
I'm Lisette Martinez, and I approve this message.
Over the past few years, the COVID-19 pandemic has affected how we live our daily lives.
Today, 1 in 5 Americans experience emotional and mental health challenges, but many of us do not understand what we are facing or how to ask for help.
At the American Psychiatric Association Foundation, we work every day to eliminate stigma, combat mental illness and substance use disorders, and advance mental health.
If you or someone you love needs help, you are not alone. Please visit mentallyhealthynation.org to learn more.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we discuss how librarians are learning to confront AI surveillance, deepfakes, and disinformation.
Allison Macrina explains how the Library Freedom Project is teaching these information guardians how to do it.
When ABC pulled Jimmy Kimmel after his critiques of corporate power, media critic Jeff Cohen saw a chilling sign of network priorities.
Jeff returns to unpack what this means for free expression, political comedy, and the media landscape. Stay with us.
I'm I'm Heidi Boghossian, New York City attorney and activist.
And I'm Maria Hall, Los Angeles civil rights lawyer.
Soon after the attacks of 9/11, when federal agents demanded library circulation records under the USA Patriot Act, librarians became unlikely whistleblowers for democracy. The so-called Connecticut Four successfully sued the FBI in 2005 over secret national security letters that sought patron data and imposed gag orders. They reminded the nation that a book borrowed in silence should never be grounds for suspicion. The Library Freedom Project was born in this climate of intrusion. It equips librarians with new skills, teaching so-called prompt literacy so they can critically evaluate generative AI outputs, training them in deep fake and voice clone detection, and raising awareness about the growing use of AI surveillance in schools and communities. In doing so, the project prepares librarians to guide the public through one of the most disruptive technologies of our time. We're joined today by Allison Macrina, activist librarian and founder of the Library Freedom Project. Since 2015, she's built a network of librarians committed to protecting privacy, defending intellectual freedom, and challenging power structures through organizing and education. Recognized with a 2023 Electronic Frontier Foundation Award, Macrina and her colleagues argue that libraries are among the last truly public goods, accessible to everyone, regardless of income or background, and that defending these spaces means defending the very foundation of free expression and information democracy. Allison, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Delighted to be here. Thank you.
Let's begin with your journey. What inspired you to create the Library Freedom Project back in 2015?
Well, I think that there's a few things that really inspired me. I mean, for one, my whole participation in the library profession was because of the lineage of library activism about speech and privacy. You know, the whole history of responding to and opposing the USA Patriot Act is what brought me into the profession as a young cub. But more specifically, I started Library Freedom Project in 2015 because of everything that had started happening around 2013. So I was very inspired by Edward Snowden and the revelations about U.S. government mass surveillance. But at the same time, what was happening too was the early Black Lives Matter movement that started after the George Zimmerman acquittal. And so the resurgent racial justice movement that started to address issues of surveillance and technology in Black and brown and over police communities. And so I saw these things happening kind of concurrently, and I realized that there was so much opportunity for the library to be responsive to the political environment, and that we as public spaces, as well as spaces of technology education, could really be at the front lines and help our communities understand, you know, what was happening in the much bigger political sphere, what was happening in the courts and with regard to policy, and also what it means to the lives of everyday people.
You often talk about information democracy. What does that term mean, and why is it so central to your work?
So maybe you all can relate to this, but what we were realizing in LFP was we had all these descriptors about our work that were very anti. You know, we're anti-surveillance, we're anti-censorship, we're anti-capitalist, we're anti-everything. And that wasn't really reckoning with, you know, that what we're really trying to do is bring about a positive vision for the world. And so we started to think about this internally. You know, what is the world we actually want? We can very easily describe all the things that we're against, but how do we talk about our positive and abundant vision? So we came up with this term information democracy because it felt like it encompasses the positive view as well as being able to give us the opportunity to talk about the things that we're against. So what we mean by information democracy is creating the conditions where people can have equity of access to information. They can seek information without fears of surveillance and censorship, where information can be in the hands of the people while also recognizing what are the power dynamics that inhibit those possibilities. You know, why do we not have information democracy? What's getting in the way of it? And so we use this as the positive frame, because I also think that it's something that librarians can really relate to. It really encompasses what we're trying to do with our work as public servants and as information stewards.
Allison, I understand that libraries are one of the few public goods that are not means tested to determine if they qualify for financial assistance. How do you see their role as equalizers in our society?
I think it has to do with both what libraries offer and also who they force interaction with. You know, I think just to say something on that second point first, there are very few spaces in our society where the space is completely non-commercial, and therefore that means that people who have no money are welcomed into the space. And I think that it's really important in a democracy or in a society that aspires to democracy that we can interact with people from all walks of life. And so libraries, I think at their best, are an opportunity to do that. But also about what is actually in the buildings. You know, it's often said if, you know, libraries were proposed today, they would never, you know, no politician would ever allow the possibility of something. It would just be ruthlessly criticized as communist or whatever. But it's pretty amazing that we've not only had these spaces for a few hundred years now, but that they're in every kind of community, and they show us the possibility of what the world could look like if we share our goods in common, if we make them free to all with very few expectations. And I think that they're really special, not just for the actual library itself, the opportunity to gain access to information, to check books out for free, but the ways that we can think about what would the rest of society be like if we took that vision elsewhere.
Well, the Library Freedom Project now trains librarians on emerging technologies as well. So how are you preparing librarians to understand and teach about artificial intelligence?
I think what is really central to us is for librarians to be the critic, to really accept the inner critical voice that they have about artificial intelligence, to see that we're in a hype cycle that's being driven by the most powerful companies in the world. And that if you're worried about this hype cycle, if you're worried about all the various ethical issues with artificial intelligence, misinformation, environmental impact, etc., that you are right to recognize that the emperor has no clothes. And so what does this mean more specifically for what we teach our librarians? I think what is really fundamental is understanding those power relationships, the enormous capital sums and the major companies that are ushering in this supposedly inevitable shift, and what those powerful forces have to gain and what our communities have to lose. And so we focus a lot on helping librarians understand those ethical issues and then helping them with ways to teach the public, engaging popular education that gets at people's sort of reservations about this world and helps them to make better choices.
Allison, I understand that one of your teaching modules is about what's called prompt literacy. What is that, and why is it a critical skill for librarians and for their communities?
Well, I think what we're talking about is, you know, drilling into the AI issue. We're talking about the proliferation of generative AI products like ChatGPT. This is part of the massive AI hype cycle that are, you know, every tech platform now is incorporating some new generative AI feature. It's at the top of your Google search results. It's in things like Canva and Slack and other tools that you might use. And so just getting back to the point about the immense power of the tech companies, their investment in AI and their push to make us all think that these technologies are unavoidable, there's nothing we can do. We try to focus our literacy our AI literacy about the ways that the AI tech stack, the entire AI tech stack, from the compute power to the data to the model development to search to operating systems, is dominated by the biggest tech companies in the world. And so recognizing that, how can our local communities understand how these tools work? How can they understand what the impact on our local communities is? Things like proliferation of data centers and the way that that influences a local ecosystem. All of these things are being pushed on us really hard. We have to reckon with that and what it means, who's doing it, what is the world they're trying to build, and what are the ideologies that are at work in creating that world.
Well, Allison, I also understand the Library Freedom Project trains librarians to recognize deep fakes, voice clones, and synthetic media. How do you teach those skills, and what tools do you recommend for spotting AI-driven deception?
You know, I think the main thing is recognizing how widespread the world of fakes and scams and different forms of fraud are, and how much artificial intelligence, as it is increasing in its power, how easy it is to be manipulated by it. And so we try to have a whole holistic popular education program about understanding the environment of scams and fraud and mis and disinformation. And I guess, you know, the best tools that we recommend for spotting those deceptions are the power of your critical thinking, while also recognizing that it's very easy. Anyone, even the most knowledgeable, the most aware person with the highest technical skills, can be manipulated by a lot of these fakes. And so we try to not shame people, help them understand that that's the environment that we live in now. If you get got by one of these scams, that you shouldn't feel too bad, because this is what they're, you know, this is their intent. But we really believe in the making the library be a place for stronger information literacy, where people can go and understand how a lot of these different things work.
Another area you cover is AI surveillance and ethics. And what should librarians know about technologies like facial recognition or predictive policing in schools and communities?
Well, unfortunately, these are the things that our society has decided are worth investment, rather than holistic and human-centered responses to things like crime or underfunding in schools, rather than invest in things like stronger teacher programs or various kinds of community responses. We have decided that the best thing we can do is to surveil the people who are most marginalized. And so I think that if librarians can understand more deeply the way that these technologies are being pushed in our communities, they can then help our patrons understand how and why to resist. So things like attending your local city council meeting, asking questions about procurement of surveillance tools, understanding how these tools work, learning about them and what they purport to do, how much they cost, what else the district is spending money on, what's the decision chain that decided facial recognition in schools or in our communities was the thing that was worth spending money on rather than something else. So a lot of our response to surveillance issues and exploitative tech comes down to community organizing and just using the library as the place that our community members can learn how to be better engaged in their local community and build more agency for themselves and their neighbors.
Well, Allison, you've said that freedom of speech isn't just about the right to speak, but it's also about the right to access information. Why is that distinction especially important in the AI era?
There's a lot that's being said right now, rightly, about how we are in an information literacy crisis. I think more broadly, a total literacy crisis. We're told that we have the sum of the world's knowledge at our fingertips, that we can just go on the internet and we can access all the information that there is and we can learn anything we want to, but that's not really true. What's happening, especially in the last couple years with the AI bubble, is that the information that's accessible to us on the internet is in fact narrowing all the time. in addition, AI has demonstrable effects on literacy, on cognition, the ability to think critically, the ability to be curious. And I think we're really only scratching the surface of that awareness and understanding of what it does to our ability to reason. And so I think that librarians have more of a role to play than ever, helping our communities understand and access a wide variety of sources, helping them to see why things like generative AI narrow the field and what interests the AI-generated results are serving.
Allison, I recently read that AI references to fake books are a source of frustration, understandably, to librarians. Can you briefly address what's happening?
Well, I think that one of the biggest issues that we see when we talk about the ethical concerns with AI is that AI has this really common tendency to hallucinate. And I hesitate to even use that language because we don't want to overly anthropomorphize generative AI. We don't want to assign human characteristics to it, but it's hard to talk about this thing that it does without talking about it like it's a person. Basically, generative AI, because it's a probability machine, quite often when you ask for something, and if you ask for something specific, like, give me a list of books to recommend to a fifth grader who's interested in science, or give me a list of citations that have to do with a certain subject, the generative AI will not, it's not reasoning in the way that a human does, where it's like, I will only find sources that really exist. What it's doing is it's creating a list of things that could possibly exist based on language patterns. And so getting back to your question, how is this coming up in the library world? We're facing now numerous library patrons who are coming in to all different types of library settings, public libraries and academic libraries, requesting materials that they have generated somehow through a generative AI prompt. And these materials don't exist. And it's creating a lot of tension because it's very hard conversation to have with a person in front of you to say, actually, what you're asking for is not real. The person who received the hallucinated material from the chatbot or whatever it was they were referencing, people can get kind of defensive about that. They feel like you're criticizing them or shaming them or something. And it's created, unfortunately, this environment of tension between the library patron and the librarian. And so it really speaks to the need that what we're really focusing on right now is such a need for popular education about how these generative AI tools work and how they are just stochastic parrots, has been said. They're just probability engines. So there is quite often when you request something from them, you have to do probably just as much work, if not more, to sleuth out whether or not the results are something real or if it's a hallucination.
Well, we're in the midst of a nationwide surge in book bans, as well as library board takeovers. How are librarians responding to these attacks on intellectual freedom?
Librarians have been fighting so hard on the front lines for, I mean, I would say this really started in earnest almost 10 years ago. I think in the last 5 or so years, it has really exacerbated. But our librarians in every local community, they are defending the most targeted people by defending those communities' right to speech, the books they need, the materials that represent their experience and reality. And I think that libraries in many ways, because of what we've been dealing with on our doorsteps for years, we anticipated this broader right-wing shift because it happening in local communities, maybe a little bit more under the radar. Sure, it's gotten a lot of attention in the media, but I think that that has not really even addressed how massive these challenges have been. And these are not grassroots attacks. They are funded by the same far right wing billionaire funding movements that have been present, unfortunately, for the last 30 or 40 years. They look like they're grassroots movements, but they're actually not. And quite often, a lot of these attacks are coming from people who don't even live in the communities where they're trying to get books banned. And so, you know, I think that our librarians, I wish I could say that we're winning the fight. I think that it's an ongoing major challenge. The librarians are fighting really hard. In some places, you know, we take sort of two steps forward, one step back. But this has been a big focus of our community activism and just trying to bring librarians together who are working on this kind of speech defense, help them to strategize with one another and help them to feel, to remember that this is the right thing and history will remember them, even if it's so hard to kind of see that there's a potential future beyond the environment of extreme hostility that we're living in right now.
Allison, how do libraries grapple with requests for materials that spread misinformation or hate?
You know, this is really hard, but I think it gets at so many of the things that we've been talking about, because there are quite a lot of, it's a major issue in the library world right now where a lot of our vendor platforms where we purchase materials from, especially where we purchase ebooks and electronic audiobooks, that have increasingly become filled with a kind of algorithmic slop that is hateful materials. So one example is a platform that we use for ebooks and electronic audiobooks called Hoopla. We discovered a few years ago that if you search for terms on Hoopla like abortion or gay rights or feminism, the first few pages of materials on each of and any of these topics that I would call, you know, sort of quote unquote controversial social issues, controversial only to some, right? The first few pages of results on this library vendor platform was all hateful materials. If you looked up the Holocaust, the first few pages were Holocaust denial. And we fought back against this vendor pretty hard. We wanted to know, you know, how did these materials come to dominate the environment? Some of them are materials that would never even make it into print editions in the library because they're not high quality enough. And so I think for me, this comes back to this conversation about power and algorithmic driven decision making and the way that we're being told that AI is, you know, revolutionizing the future, but actually what it's doing is taking over the ability for human agency to make decisions. No one was asking for this algorithmically driven right-wing material, and yet it was the dominant thing that was showing up on this platform. And I think that's part of what we're seeing happen in the library world right now, that material that our patrons are not even asking for is coming through on these information sources. But I think, you know, there's also another issue. What do we do when our patrons are asking for this material outright? Because there's quite a lot of propaganda that's spreading different hateful ideas. And so, again, this comes back to the need to educate our communities about information sources and offer many different kinds of materials in the library, many different viewpoints, so that we can at least have an abundance of information.
Looking forward, what gives you hope about the future of libraries, free expression, and the collective struggle for information democracy, especially as AI transforms how we communicate?
Something I'm really noticing in the last year or so is that the AI hype cycle and the general, as Cory Doctorow has put it, the intensification of the internet, the way that these platforms have become worse. They push more misinfo on us. They're harder. It makes it harder to find the materials that we actually want. Everything is ad driven. What I'm really seeing in the last year or so is that many, many more people are waking up to these conditions. Much more so, you know, I've been working against exploitative tech for more than a decade. And it's been a constant frustration to encounter, you know, people who are like, well, you know, surveillance is bad, but I love the ads on Instagram or whatever. What I'm seeing now is that is not so much the case anymore. And I think that there's a few things that are making this happen. One, I think that the AI hype and the way that platforms and the internet are deteriorating so rapidly, it's unavoidable, and it's having real impacts for people's lives. And I also think that there's a lot more recognition of the connection between the way that the internet is deteriorating, the environment of misinformation, the challenges to getting a good quality information sources, and the rise of far right wing movements around the world, and the way that the technology industry is a handmaiden to that. And so my hope, and what gives me hope for the future, is that I see a push for people wanting something more. And our work in libraries is trying to position them to help meet that need, to recognize what people are seeing about how technology is harming them, and help us to work together collectively to give ourselves something better and to have a more abundant future.
Allison, we continue here at Law and Disorder to be huge fans of your work. How can our listeners follow your work?
We are on the internet, on the World Wide Web at libraryfreedom.org. You can find out what's happening with us there. And there's information about joining our very low volume, very high quality monthly newsletter. You can also just send an email to info@libraryfreedom.org to join our newsletter. And the newsletter has things like events that we have upcoming, materials that we're creating, community building opportunities, things that we're reading about, things we're feeling hopeful about. And so I would love for your readers to come and join us on our mailing list.
Thank you so much for your ongoing and critically important work, Allison. Have a great day.
Thanks. Right back at you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
As the Trump administration seeks to expand presidential authority, it's not surprising that the First Amendment is making headlines. Enacted back in 1791 to protect our fundamental freedoms like free speech and a free press, it serves as a safeguard against potential abuses of government power, including censorship and other efforts to stifle dissent. Trump and his allies have made no secret about their intention to silence prominent comedians who have been critical of the administration. For example, on July 17th, CBS announced the cancellation of The Late Show with Stephen Colbert, a move that Trump publicly applauded, adding that Jimmy Kimmel would be next. Within days, the FCC approved a merger involving CBS's parent company, Paramount. Then, on September 17th, FCC Chair Brendan Carr warned that if Disney did not suspend Jimmy Kimmel for making comments about MAGA and Charlie Kirk, the FCC could get involved with ABC's licensing. Disney immediately took Jimmy Kimmel Live off the air, and even though it started back up again on September 23rd, many ABC affiliates refused to air it. And by the way, Trump has warned that Jimmy Fallon and Seth Meyers at NBC will be next to go. To help us understand what's happening, we're so fortunate to welcome back to the show our friend, journalist, media critic, lecturer, and former ACLU lawyer Jeff Cohen. Jeff co-founded Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, or FAIR, the National Media Watchdog Group, and he co-founded the online activism group RootsAction.org. He's co-produced documentary films and written several books on media bias, censorship, and freedom of speech, and he was also a paid on-air contributor on all three major cable news networks. Today, we'll be particularly focused on his most recent article in Salon called Kimmel's Suspension Shows Media Censorship is a Structural Problem. Jeff Cohen, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
It's great to be with you.
Well, let's start with the basics. Can you remind us, what did Jimmy Kimmel say that prompted his removal from the air?
Jimmy Kimmel, on the day that Charlie Kirk was assassinated, he put out a very warm, you know, regrets to the family and how awful. And then on the show that night, he slightly mischaracterized the assassin, but mostly the joke that he got into trouble for was saying something totally accurate, which is that the Trump team was exploiting this horrific assassination for its own purposes.
Let's talk about the ABC affiliate stations that are still refusing to air Jimmy Kimmel live. I understand that Nexstar and Sinclair were a driving force behind getting Kimmel suspended, and that Nexstar needs FCC approval for a $6 billion merger. Before we talk about that merger, please tell us who these companies are and how they have amassed the power to push around a media giant like Disney.
Well, Nexstar and Sinclair. Sinclair is one of the most Trumpified right-wing media companies on planet Earth. They each own or operate about 200 television stations. How did we get to this fix where you have these television behemoths, you know, that own all this? Well, for decades, the rule at the FCC was one individual or company could only own 7 television stations nationwide, 7 AM, 7 FM radio stations nationwide. During the Reagan era, that changed to 12, 12, 12. A single individual or company could only own 12 AM, 12 FM, and 12 television stations in the whole country. Well, in 1996, and this is President Bill Clinton, a Democrat, working with Newt Gingrich, the Speaker of the House, a Republican. Both of the party organizations were getting a lot of soft money from the media and telecommunications companies who wanted the ability to get even bigger. So you had this corrupt piece of legislation written behind closed doors by the corporate lobbyists, and it just loosened the caps even more so that Rupert Murdoch could build his Fox empire even bigger than it was. Clear Channel was a conservative company in Texas allied with George W. Bush. And Clear Channel, prior to the Telecommunications Act of 1996, they owned about 50 radio stations nationwide, and within a couple of years, they owned 1,200. And then you had the issue of Nexstar and Sinclair, companies mostly invested in local television stations. They only owned 12 prior to 1996, and now they own or operate about 200. That's the essence of the problem, that the media system has been turned over, sheer corruption. Remember, there's no public advocate or social movement saying, you know what we need in this country? We need to reduce the cap so a guy like Murdoch or Clear Channel, they could own more and more television and radio stations. There's absolutely no one who makes that preposterous claim. And yet over the decades, that's what's happened. So Nexstar and Sinclair together own 66 ABC television affiliates. And when Disney, because of popular pressure and protest, ended the suspension of Kimmel, they didn't run in 66 cities, including places like Portland, Oregon, Washington, D.C., a lot of places where I'm hoping there will be some protest. Seattle, St. Louis, there should be some protest to get Jimmy Kimmel back in those cities. But it's those two companies, they were allowed to blossom because of federal regulation that placed our media system in the hands of fewer and fewer, bigger and bigger companies.
Now, Jeff Cohen, you mentioned that this happened not recently, really. It was 1980s and 1990s that kind of paved the way to these media monopolies. But let's talk about the Nexstar merger. I understand it intends to buy a competitor. Is that correct? And if that deal goes through, it will create the country's largest TV company. So talk about that, and what exactly does Nexstar need from the FCC, and what First Amendment implications are at play?
Nexstar needs the FCC to approve this merger with Tegna, and they need the FCC to rewrite, to loosen the rule, the cap even more, so that instead of Nexstar and Sinclair now being able to reach 39% of the households in the country, they will be able to reach 80%. It's something that Sinclair is also lobbying for. Brendan Carr, the Trumpite FCC chair, by the way, he wrote the section in Project 25 about the FCC, and now he's the chair of the FCC. He's sort of an attack dog against people that are critical of his boss, President Trump. We've never had an FCC chair like this that made threats. So it's widely understood that Nexstar and Sinclair want to please Brendan Carr, the head of the FCC, and Brendan Carr made the threat right before Kimmel was suspended, which is, Senator Ted Cruz, the Republican senator, said that Brendan Carr was sounding like a mafioso when he said we can do it the easy way or the hard way, and he talked about taking actions against stations that did not preempt Jimmy Kimmel, and then those two companies, Sinclair and Nexstar, put pressure on Disney, and that's what culminated in the outrageous suspension. And on a Lawyers Guild show, Lawyers Guild having defended dissent for decade after decade, the reason Kimmel came back is because there were massive protests online, in the streets. There were consumer boycotts that were hurting. People were canceling their Hulu and Disney Plus subscriptions. A bunch of celebrity actors signed an ACLU petition. We have to remember that it was social action that brought Kimmel back.
Let's turn to the issue of self-censorship. When someone complies with what they think the government wants before they're ordered to do so. For example, Disney was not under any official order from the FCC to pull Jimmy Kimmel, was it? At what point does self-censorship in the media become complicity in authoritarianism?
Yeah, we're already at that point of complicity. These companies all want the ability to get even bigger. No matter how vast they are, they always want to get bigger. Disney is trying to take over the FUBU streaming service, which they will then merge with what they already own, Hulu. And that merger has to be approved. It's now, I think, being scrutinized by Trump's Justice Department. So this complicity with authoritarianism, we've never had a president like Trump who is so attacking the media every single day, sometimes many times in a day. It's way beyond what Nixon did. We never had an FCC chair like Brendan Carr. And we've never had media companies that were so vast that they were ready to be complicit in any of the demands to remove this person or that person. And the way it's played out is Trump files these harassment, frivolous lawsuits that he could not possibly win in court. And then these conglomerates have caved in. And anyone who then works at ABC News or CBS News knows that the boss is complicit and doesn't want any content on their air that in any way offends Trump. You'll remember that ABC News, Stephanopoulos, was sued by Trump over comments he made over the civil case that Trump lost on sexual assault. And it was a defamation case that ABC Disney could not lose. But Disney and the ABC News journalists bristled ABC gave what amounted to a thinly disguised bribe of $15 million to settle a defamation case they couldn't have lost. Meta did the same thing. That's Mark Zuckerberg, who's increasingly been cozy with Trump. You know, they had taken Trump, suspended him, pursuant to their well-known policy that if you incite violence, we will suspend you. And they suspended Trump after January 6th. He filed a frivolous lawsuit. Meta could not lose. They own Facebook and Instagram. And yet they gave $25 million to Trump and Trump's non-existent library. And then you come up to Paramount, which, as we all know, has said that Colbert will be off the air in May. Paramount also owns Comedy Central. I don't think The Daily Show is going to last beyond May. I'm going to be surprised if Colbert and The Daily Show last until May. But they were sued. It was even more frivolous. They were sued over how 60 Minutes, one of the most profitable TV news shows in history, the way 60 Minutes edited a Kamala Harris interview, and they gave a thinly disguised bribe of, I believe it was $16 million to Trump. Colbert went on the air and called it a big fat bribe, and then he was terminated as of May of next year. So these companies are completely complicit. For the legal people in your audience, none of these suits could have been won by the Trump side. And it was a way for all of these companies to give fat bribe-like payments to Trump or Trump's future presidential library. So that's the problem, that these few conglomerates have so much power. Imagine you're a journalist at ABC News or CBS News, and you watch your conglomerate sell out news principles by caving in on these suits that the journalist could not have lost in court.
If you're just tuning in, this is Law and Disorder. I'm Maria Hall, and my co-host Heidi Boghossian and I are interviewing journalist, media critic, and lecturer Jeff Cohen. So, Jeff, last week, Trump suggested that any TV stations that allow criticism of him should lose their FCC licenses. We are being aired right now over the public radio waves with a time-honored tradition of criticizing the government, regardless of who is in power. With this developing story, why is it so important to have content-neutral decisions being made about media?
Well, traditionally, the FCC has been content neutral. They have not intimidated. We've never had presidents. Nixon did it a little bit, but President Trump is doing it in spades. We've never had this situation. So in terms of like Pacifica radio stations or community radio stations, they are the last bastion because they are nonprofits. They are not owned by these big media conglomerates. So in terms of listeners to this show, what you need to be doing is with your dollars and with your social media and email, spread the word to friends and neighbors about the local radio station, the nonprofit that you're listening to, and donate. Because, you know, these conglomerates will not stand up for the First Amendment. Pacifica Radio has had a history of decades of standing up, the right to dissent, putting on voices that don't get into the mainstream corporate news. And that tradition is